Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director Alfred Hitchcock and his 1929 film Blackmail. Returning on the show today to talk about Blackmail is Professor Mike Giuliano. Professor Giuliano, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
So, a while ago with Westhaver, we talked about a film called One Wonderful Sunday. It's an old Kurosawa film, kind of back when he was still really early in his career. And we talked. The main thing we talked about with that film, how it felt like he hadn't hit his peak yet. It wasn't at that time when Kurosawa was just hitting home run after home run, when it seemed like. And like, it compares it to this movie, because this is very early in Hitchcock's career. He wasn't even like 30 when he made this film. And while it's not a bad movie, I still think that there's a few things in there that shows me he hasn't hit peak Hitchcock yet. He isn't hitting home run after home run.
Well, I firmly subscribe to the auteur theory, and on the plus side, when you think about the directorial intelligence, that kind of sensibility, and then you look for it throughout the career. In Hitchcock's case, having directed 53 films, we're inclined to find it everywhere, aren't we?
Yeah.
The Hitchcock touch. But on the minus side there, potentially, is that with auteur-driven theorizing, what will happen is you can look at early work or, frankly, later and really inferior work on occasion. And Hitchcock made some bad films both early and late. And somehow read more into them than should be read into them. In other words, and I plead guilty on that score. Mm-hmm. There's some Hitchcock films where I'll say, well, you know, it's not a very good film, but. And then I'll start special pleading for the film. I actually think Blackmail is a very good film. It does have some obvious flaws and drawbacks, but I think it really is an indication of Hitchcock hitting his stride there. And indeed, Hitchcock himself said he didn't really hit his stride until his third film, The Lodger, in 1926. It's the first truly distinctive Hitchcock film where, whether you're an auteurist or not, the moment you watch it, you know you're watching a Hitchcock film.
Yes.
His first two films, I don't think one would say that. And having made a number of films in the late 20s of variable quality, I mean, I've seen almost all of them, and some of them are not particularly good, but they're interesting just because they're Hitchcock, right?
Yeah.
You want to see what works and what doesn't, and people he's working with that he'll work with again and so on. But I think you can easily say that The Lodger is the first Hitchcock film, as Hitchcock himself said, the first true Hitchcock film. And Blackmail, I think, is where you really see him kind of coalescing his creative forces. In other words, his themes, the way in which he works the camera, editing, sound, et cetera, this really is Hitchcock hitting his stride. But for some reasons we can talk about, it's not an entirely smooth ride,
mm-hmm.
and does have a kind of halting and I would say even like lurching quality sometimes. And there's some technological reasons as much as anything else for that.
Yeah, we might as well start. I think this is from 1929. This is believed the first talkie that was produced in England, and I think that's the main problem I have with this movie, is that it feels like this should have been a silent movie. I think there's a lot of dubbing in the film that feels very off. As an audio person, I always, like, my biggest pet peeves in movies are bad dubbing. That's why whenever I watch a foreign film, I always demand subtitles and with original language and not dubbed over in English. And the dubbing is bad, and there's just a lot of elements that I think it feels like there are a lot of parts in this movie that feel like a silent movie, but the sound and the talking is unnecessary, and I think it would have worked better as a silent film.
Ah, well, it actually was a silent
yep.
film. What happens is that we all talk about sound coming to Hollywood in 1927 and tend to forget sometimes that the jazz singer was a part talkie,
mm-hmm.
part silent, part talkie. And there were a number of hybrid films like that in 27, 28, and that's why by 1929, Hollywood could boast about, you know, all talking, all singing, all dancing, et cetera. And as sound came to other film industries, it came just a little bit later. So what Hollywood went through in 27, 28, Great Britain was going through in, let's say, 29, and similar issues would come up. Blackmail from 1929 is indeed the first talkie in the British film industry. And it's not just that we say that about it now. That's how it was advertised. That really is the, mm-hmm. the official production history. Now, the backstory is that Hitchcock had begun Blackmail as a silent picture. It was going to be completely silent. But then he learned during production that sound equipment was available to him. And so he decided to reshoot portions of the film. It gets even more devious than that. And I say devious deliberately because his producers wanted him just to go ahead and make a silent film. Like, you know, just shoot the film the way you always shoot it. And so Hitchcock was officially shooting it as a silent picture, but he was surreptitiously shooting some of the scenes with sound. And it's a kind of patchwork of the opening section of the film is silent for about, 6 minutes or so. And there's some other scenes in the film that are essentially silent, and they'll have sound, you know, one way or another on top of them. And then there's some other scenes that really are direct sound recording. It's a that's one reason why the film itself has a kind of patchwork quality, because it literally was. And Hitchcock, again, you know, being young and not really powerful as a director at that point, was going against his boss's orders when he was shooting it. But as it went further into the shoot, he at that point had something resembling their blessing, if not full blessing. And he was actually then not only shooting some scenes with sound, but he was reshooting portions of the film that had been silent. And where it gets really kind of complicated and messy, and these are technological problems that came up, is that the female protagonist is a woman named Alice White. And every scene in which that character appears, and there are a lot, had to be reshot. And the reason is this, that the actress playing that character, the female lead, the actress's name is Annie Ondra. She was Polish, rather. And she had worked extensively in the film industry in several European countries. And she also had been established already as an actor in British film, but this is silent film we're talking about, and it was not an issue. I mean, she was, you know, forceful as an actor, you know, easy on the eyes and so on. I mean, it would not be a problem in a silent film, but the moment she opened her mouth and spoke, she had this, you know, heavy Central European accent, I mean, specifically Polish. And so Hitchcock had to figure out, well, what to do with this accent? We can't, when you're saying it's hard to hear the dialogue sometimes, imagine if it had been her dialogue not only poorly recorded in English, but with a heavy Polish accent. You'd never know what she was saying. Yeah. Like, why'd you kill the guy? To sort of cut to the chase on this in a chase film. If she were to explain herself, you wouldn't understand what she's saying. So Hitchcock realized he had to reshoot all of the scenes with Annie Ondra. And what he did was he did reshoot them with the same Polish actress. However, the British actress, Joan Barry, stood just off camera speaking her lines as Ondra pantomimed them. This was, to say the least, a very awkward arrangement, but a necessary one. And the reason it was necessary at that time, and bear in mind this is 1929 in England, the reason it was so necessary was that the kind of post-dubbing that we take for granted was not possible at that early date. Within a few years, it would be. At that point, you couldn't just say, well, we'll dub it later. No, they actually would have an actress pantomiming as she would have in a silent film, and somebody speaking into a microphone just out of the frame. Right. So that's why, like, sometimes even, like, her timing, her reaction seems slightly off. Well, I mean, I feel sorry for her in that situation. I mean, imagine trying to give a normal performance under abnormal conditions.
Yeah, and like, it's so funny you were describing this, like, wow, this feels exactly like the plot of Singing in the Rain with Lena Lamont.
Lena Lamont, I know.
And like you said, like, that's like, as an audio, as somebody who's always an audio person, it's all like, that's one of the things that always take my pet peeves, is that takes me out of it, is like, even though you said it's not dubbing, but when what you see on the screen is not matching up with what you're hearing, and that just ticks a little box in my head, which just crawls under my skin. It just almost takes me out of any movie, whether it's good or not. Like I said, when it comes to like martial arts films or anything foreign, I always demand original language, as I hate dubbing.
Well, here's a problem that comes up throughout early British film history, at least for American viewers and American ears. Mm-hmm. Technologically, it's not as advanced as what Hollywood or Germany or other industries were. And specifically, the sound recording, to my ears, is sometimes rather tinny. And it can be that way in really early Hollywood films, but they kind of get that worked out by the early 30s. In the British industry, it's oftentimes, I think, still an issue through the 30s. The sound recording was never really great. And then when you get a degraded print that you're watching decades later, a saving grace for us now is that as Criterion and other conscientious distributors restore and re-release films, we're getting better picture quality and better sound in some cases, but still not great sound. And the reason I say for American ears is that the Brits would understand some of that more readily than we will. I mean, I see a lot of British films today where I feel the need for subtitles.
And Trainspotting.
Particularly, you know, with regional accents and so on. A lot of the Mike Leigh, Ken Loach films and so on. And some of them have actually been released in the States with English subtitles, English language with English subtitles. Not as an option, but put right on the print.
Yes.
So anyway, back to the Hitchcock films. That's something that I think is a problem. And compounding that is that a lot of these actors, really were coming out of a stage background. And on the one hand, you have good diction, but on the other hand, you're accustomed to an audience that's like sharing the room with you. And that's not quite the same as speaking when you know it's into a microphone and going through that whole process. So sometimes in terms of the delivery, it's not paced or it's not delivered in quite the way that would be, you know, ideally conducive for sound recording technology. Those things ultimately get more or less worked out, but I think it can be frustrating watching the early British talkies. Some of them I end up watching as if they were silent films because I can't quite understand what they're saying.
Yeah, and that's what's so interesting about this movie. You're talking about silent, because like the first like 6 minutes or so of this movie, and I was watching it, and I was like, wait a second, I thought this was a talking film. Like, this feels like something out of a silent movie. You got the music, you've got even the way the expressions are, everything. This is a silent movie, and I wonder why they kept that first 6 minutes or so of the film silent, and then everything else was a talkie.
Well, that's one reason why it's an awkward film in that respect. And this is kind of curious talking point, because on the one hand, you're absolutely right that if you're going to make a talkie, make a talkie. If you're reshooting, reshoot everything. But with the production conditions as we've described, it was not a matter of like smoothly and seamlessly just reshooting the whole film. They were kind of patching it together. And these are relatively low budget films, and they're on a tight production schedule. They don't have the luxury of a lot of money and a lot of time, and they're kind of cobbling it together as best they can. But the reason in particular it's a difficult, not difficult so much as kind of complicated talking point, is that push come to shove, Hitchcock began in the silent era, and I would argue essentially remained a silent filmmaker throughout his career. For all the brilliance of many of the scripts, the sparkling dialogue and all that, and for all the masterful sound design in a lot of the later films, Hitchcock always thought essentially of a film as a series of pictures, hence his love of storyboarding.
Yes.
You draw it out that way. And a reminder that he had entered the British film industry in 1920, and he was designing title cards. And actually for the English branch of Paramount. And what he would do is he would place dialogue on the cards, and he also would do drawings that were suitable. And he found himself working a lot with screenwriters and cinematographers in the planning of a picture. But that his early training really was thinking about, well, it's a series of pictures, and we need to put in cards as required. In other words, he's thinking primarily visually, and he's really beginning as an artist, right? Mm-hmm. He's thinking visually, and you use words when you have to. And this might be the place to interject that he shared that interest in visual storytelling with the great German directors. And a lot of folks either don't know or kind of forgotten that Hitchcock actually, although he began his career in England in the early 20s, he began his directorial career in Germany. His first two films, The Pleasure Garden in 1925 and The Mountain Eagle in 26, were actually shot in Germany. And while Hitchcock was in, because a lot, like just as Hollywood went over to Berlin to study the German film industry and invite them back, Hitchcock himself made the shorter trip from England to Germany. And here's a really neat biographical observation, and it ties into something you and I talked about recently on this show. We were discussing F.W. Murnau's Sunrise, you know, a great German director working in Hollywood. Here's somebody making the trip the other way. Hitchcock, when he was in Germany, actually had an opportunity to watch Murnau direct The Last Laugh.
Oh, wow.
He was actually on the set watching that. And that was a film, as you and I mentioned recently on this show, that's a film, a German film, that essentially dispensed with title cards and told its story visually.
Any.
So here's Hitchcock, who had entered the industry making title cards, but already thinking about, can we get by with as few of these as possible and have a series of pictures? And Hitchcock later stated, and this is a direct quote from Hitchcock, "The Last Laugh was almost the perfect film. It told its story entirely by the use of imagery, and that had a tremendous influence on me. The German filmmakers were trying very hard to express ideas in purely visual terms," close quote. So when you think about Hitchcock's whole career, think about so many of the really spectacular set pieces that really are pictorial, visual storytelling, push come to shove. Even though, you know, the sound effects and the dialogue, all that's terrific, he truly is a case where you can turn down the sound and watch it just as a series of pictures. And then secondly, It reinforces the extent to which Hitchcock was really influenced by German Expressionism. We've talked about Hollywood being influenced by that. You see it reflected in everything from gangster movies to horror movies, film noir, all that. You see it in Hitchcock. When you think about a lot of the camera angles, you think about sharp contrasts, you think about a certain sensibility. He is, in a lot of ways, a German Expressionist. I mean, that really had a lasting impact on him. And so he brings that back with him. And so when he makes The Lodger in 1926, look at the camera angles, look at the sharp lighting effects he achieves in that film. Think about the overall sensibility. You could imagine The Lodger being made in Germany. I mean, it was made in England, but you could imagine a German director making it in Germany, right? It's that kind of a story. You know, where you get into stories of criminal minds and how they operate and how everything becomes destabilized in the world. The usual distinctions between good and evil start to blur in certain ways. All those disturbing notions, which are part of the German psyche, I think arguably are part of Hitchcock's.
Yeah, and we were talking about The Lodger. Isn't there like a very notable shot in The Lodger where it's shot from under a glass table?
He has a lot of shots like that, yeah. I mean, that's a striking example, but he'll often do that. And again, where it's deliberately distorted, exaggerated, you know, a kind of emotional fervor. And the fact that, you know, he has those central figures, protagonists, that really oftentimes are what we would call anti-heroes, like deeply flawed or you know, is the good guys oftentimes aren't entirely good, right? And the bad guys maybe are charming.
Yes.
So they meet somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, it's especially in this movie, because one of the things I wrote down is like noir-ish with the question mark, which bringing in that influence of German Expressionism. I saw a little bit of the kind of the shadows with a bit of the Venetian blinds and the fact that, yeah, there's nobody really coming out clean in this entire movie.
Well, to that point, the script was by Hitchcock, Charles Bennett, his longtime screenwriter. I actually went to a program once where Bennett was in his 90s at that point and had worked with Hitchcock since the 1920s and then certainly worked with him a lot in the 30s. And his ill health didn't allow him to be there in person, but he joined us by phone. And he talked a lot about working with Hitch in the 20s and 30s and how closely Hitchcock always worked with his screenwriter collaborators. And so on this script, it was Charles Bennett, Hitchcock, and Ben Levy. And they wanted to write a story that seems to be fairly simple in terms of a murder and chase scenario, but they wanted to work in a lot of moral ambiguity, and that's the point you were making there. Mm-hmm. So a quick quote from the Hitchcock scholar and biographer Donald Spoto. He refers to, quote, Hitchcock's constant reversal of the expected. Judgments about what to consider infallibly right and true and good, about forces commonly called evil, and about the prestige accorded to human authorities are questioned in Hitchcock's films with as much insistence as wit. One of the director's clearest presentations of this theme, that the figures of law and order and the common good are themselves eminently corruptible, is made in Blackmail, wherein the apparent righteousness of the police is completely undermined.
Yeah, and it's interesting because watching this film and knowing that just a few years later we get what we have in America with the Hays Code, like this is a pretty risque film for its time. I mean, basically the main thing that drives this force is the artist attempts to rape the woman and then she kills them. I mean, she kills him. And also you have that, but also, you know, there's scenes when she's undressing. And like I was watching this, like, wow, I'm surprised, like, 1930s that they were able to get away with this. Now I know this is England, this is in America, but did they have strict... You're showing me this picture, and yeah, wow. Like, once again.
If you could see us on radio, what I'm showing Alex at the moment is we're looking at an original release poster for Blackmail, and the female protagonist is just wearing her slip, and she looks like she's just been violated, to put it rather bluntly. I mean, she has a traumatized look on her face. Mm-hmm. She's really upset. And this is a woman who has, you know, firsthand known, you know, rape and murder and terrible things. So, you know, the look on her face and the way she's partly unclothed. And this is the actual poster that you would have seen.
Yes,
like at
wow.
the theater. You know, this isn't something like you'd slip to a friend on the QT. This is the actual release poster. One of the poster designs that actually was used. And so you realize that in terms of the film being risque, this was not something that would surprise you when you entered the theater and saw the film. You would have seen the poster and already had that jolt. You would have gone in expecting to see exactly what you and I are looking at in this poster. But to partly cut against that and cut against it in this sense, certainly a lot of Hollywood films in the late 20s were risque. A surprising to us degree of innuendo and partial nudity and so on. These are, of course, the notorious and hence very enjoyable pre-code films. You know, late 20s, particularly early 30s. Really, you know, before the Hays office started to clamp down. And even though the Hays office, the production code went into effect in 1930 in Hollywood, it wasn't strictly enforced until 1934, and hence those pre-code films, as they're called, even though they, ironically, in most cases, were released under the code. But that's Hollywood. But when we look at England as well, and Germany and elsewhere, it's, for me, yet another reminder. And this semester I'm teaching a course on Hollywood in the 1920s, so we talk about it all the time. The 1920s was a very modern decade in a lot of ways. And a lot of people, in terms of issues of women in the workforce, just women in society and so on. And it's not an entirely unmixed blessing because, you know, you have to actually watch particular examples as to how are women being presented here. But there was a more overt presentation of sexuality. And again, it's much more complicated than that in terms of the signals being sent. But the fact that we were finally breaking free of the Victorian corsets, if you will, and it was a freer presentation, the flapper era and everything associated with that. You know, if you look at a Hollywood film like Our Dancing Daughters with Joan Crawford, some of these late 20s films, these are liberated women in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That they're drinking, they're carrying on, they're initiating affairs, they're doing all kinds of stuff. And in a film like Blackmail, you realize that Hitchcock at that point is kind of pushing the envelope. There was a British Board of Censors, and they weren't shy about intervening, but you have to realize the overall climate was somewhat permissive in Britain as well at the time. And I don't think to the degree as in Hollywood, but it was not, let's put it this way, it was not out of the ordinary that a movie like Blackmail would have a poster like the one I've just described to you.
Yeah, and even because one of the things I know about the Hays Code in America is that, you know, what the person does a bad thing, like commit a murder or something, they always have to be punished. You can't let them get away with it. In this movie, she gets away with it. Now, she, you know, it was self-defense. You could definitely say that. But still, once again, you have something like this in the Hays Code era, I'm not sure if they would allow her to get away unscathed with the murder.
Well, let's, for the sake of the audience, just reprise there that, you know, you have a boyfriend-girlfriend situation, mm-hmm. and he's actually a police detective, right? So,
yeah.
So, you know, they're at a club, they have an argument, she's going to hook up with an artist she knows, and the artist is going to invite her back to his studio, and it's that cliched situation, and cliches are true oftentimes, right?
Yeah.
You know, the artist saying, come up and look at my etchings, basically, and she accepts the invitation, and that's where it's going to lead to him making a sexual advance and you know her horror at that and the ensuing physical altercation between them. She's going to take, this is a lovely Hitchcock, I mean, murder's not lovely, but Hitchcock can make it seem that way sometimes because you know that when she kills him, it's we know as the audience because we're privy to this, right? We know that she's justified. It's self-defense.
Yes.
She's fighting for her life. So all joking aside on that, she's as terrified as the woman's face I just described in the poster, and she's fighting for her life. But the kind of delicious touch from a Hitchcockian perspective is that she kills the artist with a bread knife. Hitchcock loved to have scenes where something that's ordinarily a normal domestic implement or, in the proper bourgeois household suddenly becomes a murder weapon. I mean, think of, like, in a very late Hitchcock film, Torn Curtain from 1966.
Oh, yeah.
Not a particularly good film, but a great sequence.
That one sequence, yeah.
The one sequence in the kitchen where, you know, if it's a Cold War scenario and if it's like spy versus spy kind of thing and you're up against the Ruskies in effect, you know, to put somebody's head in an oven and with the German context no less, that it's kind of like, you know, killing somebody that way. But it's like, you know, killing somebody in a kitchen or other late Hitchcock films like Frenzy and others where, you know, people will be talking about murder and mayhem, but they're talking about it over dinner, let's say. Or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like you have these like normal, happy, healthy domestic situations, but it's sort of like the wife saying, well, how was your day at the office, dear? You know, and if he's describing, you know, whatever, the criminal case, you realize, well, wait a minute now. You know, they're talking about murder and gory stuff and all, but you know, here it's at the dinner table. And Hitchcock loved to do things like that. So to backtrack, and one reason why Blackmail is one of the first, you know, really distinctively Hitchcockian Hitchcock films, is the fact that, you know, that it would be a bread knife being mm-hmm. used, you know, rather than just buttering bread. I mean, you pick up what's at hand, right? And that becomes your murder weapon. But anyway, the fact then that, you know, you have then this woman that we know has committed a murder and we know did it out of reasons of self-defense. So there aren't any qualms that way. Where we have moral qualms, and where they will have them for sure as characters, is in how are they going to handle that? Like, will the woman open up and confess and tell what really happened? Will she try to keep it to herself? Moreover, will her more or less boyfriend, who of course is the law, it's not just a matter of calling the police, but when you are the police, how will he handle that? And that's what you're alluding to in terms of how it plays out. In a conventional Hollywood film, it's that sin and salvation formula. You can do a lot of sinning for, you know, 80 minutes, but in the final 10 minutes, or at least the final 10 seconds, you better come clean. And what Hitchcock does in this film, and I don't know if we should spoil it for people who haven't seen the film, is
spoiler alert. There we go.
Well, but it's a morally complicated scenario in that sense, as in, well, is there good and is there evil and a clear distinction between them, or do good people sometimes do bad things? But if you murder somebody out of self-defense, well, is that bad even? But then, how do you handle it after the fact? How do you deal with that? And if you're trying to keep your own involvement, your own complicity, and this is not just her complicity as the murderer, because, is it murder when it's self-defense like that? But, you know, she did kill a man. How should she handle it? Should she try to hide it, conceal it? And then even more compelling, I think, is then for her boyfriend, who is the law, how should he handle it? And that's where in the home stretch of the film, if you will, if you have an opportunity to pin the crime on a bad person, the actual blackmailer, there's a blackmailer character, if you have the opportunity to pin this crime on him, isn't that the smoothest, the easiest course of action for you to take? Because after all, you, who are the law, and your girlfriend would be totally off the hook at that point. You know, you'd be totally free and clear. And this blackmailer had tried to blackmail you because he was a witness. It was like, you know, a guy on the street sees her going to the artist's apartment. You know what I mean? Like, there's a man who has seen enough that he would have reason to try to blackmail them. And it's not just that he's trying to blackmail them, but from what they know and what they learn of him, he's a really scuzzy character, right? Yeah. So why not pin it on him? Because he's got a record. He's got a police record. He's no good. You know, just lock him up again, right? And then everyone's happy at that. The blackmailer wouldn't be happy, but everyone else would be happy in a sense, or at least mm-hmm. off the hook there. And that's the moral crisis that will come at the end. Now, in a conventional Hollywood film, you would have to have people come clean, sort of like right down the line, so that law and order are reinforced and everybody's a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout and so on. Hitchcock is much more wicked about it. He mm-hmm. leaves a lot, not so much fully unresolved, as just simply showing you that, you know, good people are not always entirely good, and sometimes they do things out of self-interest to kind of cover their tracks or conceal themselves and so on. And maybe they would consider, you know, letting somebody else take the fall. And of course, the blackmailer literally will take a fall at the end. But you see what I'm getting at is that Hitchcock is intellectually mature at this point, and he gives you an ending that is really fascinating, and yet it's not conventional morality at that point.
Yeah, and it brings out, it's a very, the ending is very interesting because while she gets away with it, you don't know how entirely well she's always going to be, because it seems that they've made away with it, they're clean, but then what does she see? She sees that painting that was in his studio, and it's that one with the clown, the kind of the fat-looking clown. He's laughing and all pointing at it, and she keeps seeing that. She saw it after she committed the murder, so she got upset and she tore a part of it off. So it seems like that painting is always going to haunt her throughout her life.
Yeah, and she had actually, you know, she had signed it. She, you know, it was mm-hmm. it was like evidence that way, and then painted it over. And then you're right. Part of her fury was then to take a knife and to stab the painting.
Yeah.
If you're gonna kill an artist, even worse is to kill his art, right? So start taking the knife that way. But then, you know, even when you think like that's a horrible past chapter, it comes back to haunt, doesn't it? So it's like towards the end of the film, what should be carried in but the painting itself? And you know, again, this is sort of a, you know, quite, I mean, Freudian interpretations were rampant in the 20s and 30s mysteries and drama and in a lot of ways. And I'm not saying this is overtly Freudian, but simply at the level of this is always going to play out in her mind, right?
Yeah, so it's not,
strictly speaking, it's not just Freudian there. It's just simply, you know, when you've experienced something like that, can you ever truly purge it? You know, can you ever really come clean entirely? She had intended to come clean at the end. She was going to confess, right? She was going to be a Girl Scout and do the right thing there. And then, you know, circumstances intervened, if you will. But it's a matter of, you know, how much can be left unresolved or open to chance at that point, as in how things will play out. Like, will she confess and totally have everything pinned on her, but, you know, justified killing? Or will something else happen so that she can be off the hook? And you know, it's still that central quandary of, should we entirely come clean, or depending on how things play out, we can get away with this? You know, I mean, we're relatively innocent as killing scenarios go, but we don't have to be sullied by this. You know what I mean? We can have it pinned on somebody else, and the blackmailer himself has fallen to his death, and so he's not there to defend himself and to deny anything. So let the dead man take that tale with him, you know, that have it pinned on him. And if we're a boyfriend, girlfriend, you know, we can still have that. But you make the very good observation that it's a short film. It's under 90 minutes. But as they sort of walk away from all of this, they don't really walk away. Can they fully walk away? Because it's going to always play out in their minds. How it would affect their future relationship? Well, that's for the audience to speculate in their own imaginations. But it's not one of these gee whiz happy endings at all, is it?
Yeah, and even not only with that scene, but the when it's the morning after, and one of the women at the shop she works at is talking about the murder, and she keeps saying knife, and she goes knife, blah blah blah, blah knife, blah, 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 knife, knife, and then she just keeps getting louder and louder, and that's another thing that's always going to stick with her.
I love that moment, and in fact, it's a reminder that on the one hand, sound recording technology was in its infancy and very crude, and not recording voices well, and so on. But on the other hand, and I want to stress this, on the other hand, because it was brand new, film directors in particular thought, this is a brave new world, let's explore it. And in Great Britain, Hitchcock has some wonderful sound effects in films like Blackmail and Murder, and films from like the late 20s, early 30s. And you know, the point you mentioned there, that the word knife, so you know, that word does come across loud and clear. Yeah. I don't know all the other dialogue as to how well that translates, but you know what? Well, you hear someone going, knife. And that's brilliant, actually. That's wonderful. It's a reminder that in the early 30s in France, René Clair was making films like A Nous la Liberté, which also have incredibly creative sound design. And these are really early sound films in France. And so it's not unusual to have directors do that, because they're exploring the possibilities of not an entirely new medium, but a kind of adjunct to the existing medium. In other words, you've had the films as a series of pictures, but now with sound, it's not just dialogue, it's sound itself, right? What you can do with it. And what happens, ironically and kind of sadly, and I'm not pinning this on any one director, because directors like René Clair in France and Hitchcock in Britain, they really were pushing the envelope with what they could do with sound. And in Hollywood, too, actually, there's some very inventive sound pictures early on. What happens is a kind of leveling effect, and this is industry-wide. As the sound recording technology gets better, it gets more standardized. On the one hand, that's good because, you know, more consistent sound quality. On the other hand, it becomes kind of routinized or conventionalized, and this is how we record sound. I'm getting at, you don't have as many experiments with how to use sound on film. And so even though, as we said earlier, Blackmail is a kind of patchy picture in various ways, I'm fascinated by the fact that there will be a sequence that still is essentially a silent film for 5 or 6 minutes, and then another scene that not only uses sound, but, you know, to creatively, you know, put the emphasis, lean on that word knife. And as you and I talk about it, I'm hearing that dialogue in my head. It stays with you, right? And there's something about that that's just so creative and so wicked to use sound that way.
Yeah, and we've been talking a lot about Hitchcock, and, you know, this is highlights a thing I think maybe a lot of Hitchcock fans don't really know about, at least more the casual ones, as far as people think about his movies, they always just think about the stuff he did in Hollywood, starting with Rebecca in 1940 up and through the 60s with, like, Marnie. And I think people forget that even before Rebecca, he had, like he spoke with this film, he had a career of, like, 15, 20 years in Britain. And even he came back in late 1970s to do Frenzy, which I considered to be like one of his last great films. So he had, I don't think a lot of people know this film or The Lady Vanishes or The 39 Steps or Frenzy, because they usually just focus more on his Hollywood work.
Well, you know what? One of the great things about a long career like Hitchcock's, and one reason why he's among my favorite directors is not just his talent, which is immense, as was his girth.
Hey-o.
But the fact that there's a generational argument I would make. Hitchcock was born in 1899, and he grew up with the medium. As film was maturing as a medium, he was entering the industry. And if you look at that generation of Hollywood directors, it's the John Ford generation, if you will, mm-hmm. William Wellman and so on, tough guy directors in those cases. But what they share, and they're otherwise very different as directors, but what they share is the fact that typically they enter the film industry, whether in Hollywood or in England or wherever, you know, somewhere in the teens, late teens, certainly by the 1920s, they're entering it during the silent film era, at a time when they would have had no way of knowing necessarily that there would be sound cinema. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You have to put yourself back then. It's 1922 or something. You're making pictures, right? And literally pictures. But they begin in that silent era, and you can make the case also with John Ford even that, the, you know, Ford did his storyboarding in the head, but he's visualizing the picture before he shoots it. Hitchcock did the actual storyboarding. For him, the most creative part of the process. And this is a long-winded way of answering your question, but the fact that their careers go way back and they have really long careers. And when you start to watch Hitchcock's British films, there are so many of them.
Yeah.
And again, they vary greatly in quality, but they're all interesting because they're Hitchcock, right? And so when you see how many films he was making in the late 20s and then through the 30s, a few of those films, like The 39 Steps, are extremely well-known. A Lady Vanishes, Man Who Knew Too Much, the first version, things like that. But there's some other films where they really are obscure. Sometimes they weren't readily available for years or just poor print quality. I used to suffer through some of them.
Yeah, there's quite a lot
ago.
In the public domain.
Oh, my God. Yeah, but that's a mixed blessing because some of the films in public domain
are just awful.
Are awful because, you know, the sound, not just the sound being garbled, but visually garbled, like really terrible prints. And so anyway, some of those films have been hard to see. Even when you can see them, they're hard to see. Yeah. And so back to your point, Hitchcock had a very full career in England before he came to Hollywood. And the thing is, just as American film producers had been watching the German studios in the 1920s and then inviting those directors and actors to come over to Hollywood, in the 1930s, by the 30s, and even, I would say, late 20s, they were paying attention to what was going on in Great Britain. Because after all, that was a common market, if you will. We did share the same language there. And the Hollywood studios, after all, when Hitchcock started doing those title cards in 1920, he was working for Famous Players Lasky, which we know as Paramount, what became Paramount Pictures. He was working for an American studio initially. Mm-hmm. And Hitchcock actually, in interviews, has said that, you know, his career really owes a lot to the Germans, but also to the Americans, that because he was working with an American film studio in the early 20s, his major influences and his paycheck, if you will, has been cut by the Americans. So they had active business interests in England for distributing American films there and for buying British films to show back in the States. So that he was on their radar for quite a while. But certainly by the 30s, when he had a real established track record, David O. Selznick in particular was the American producer who really had his eye on Hitchcock and who invited him to work in America. And to say that Hitchcock hit the ground running is an extreme understatement, because when he made his first American film, Rebecca, in 1940, it was a critical commercial hit. And indeed, Rebecca won the Academy Award for Best Picture, and Hitchcock received an Academy Award nomination as Best Director. I'll quickly add by way of grievances, which always harbors, that Hitchcock, of course, never won a competitive Oscar in mm-hmm. his whole career. I mean, talk about shocking things. That's more shocking than anything in Psycho, right?
Yeah, neither did Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah. Well, get me started on that. We could then go on to the Nobel Prize for Literature. And how could Tolstoy not win it? How could James Joyce not win it? But you got me started on that. But back to Rebecca, the fact that when Hitchcock came to Hollywood, American viewers knew him because his principal British films had been shown in American theaters. They knew him, and certainly a producer like Selznick. And bear in mind, Selznick had just produced Gone with the Wind, right? So this guy's riding high, and what's he got on his front burner? Having Hitchcock come over to Hollywood. And now, Rebecca's a very conventional film by Hitchcock's standards, But it was his calling card for Hollywood, to show that he could make a Hollywood feature. It had more production value. It had a kind of patina. But it also, of course, does have some of the psychological elements you expect in a Hitchcock film.
Him and Selznick were the best of friends, weren't they?
Well, I don't think it'd be easy to be David Selznick's friend. These producers are tough guy characters in their own way. So he didn't work with Selznick for too long. And you know, I mean, Hitchcock as an auteurist wants to call all the shots. Selznick was the kind of producer who liked to control everything. And so you're going to butt heads in a situation like that, for sure.
Yeah. Because even I remember seeing a picture, the first time I saw a picture of David O. Selznick, like, oh, that's where they got the inspiration for Thorwald, the look of Thorwald.
Bingo.
Yeah. All right. Anything else about, getting close to my questions, is there anything else about Hitchcock or blackmail, anything else you want to bring up?
Well, one thing that's among its merits is that it's got a relatively brief running time. It's like, what, about 84 minutes or so? And why do I say that? Well, as with so many Hollywood and British films, late 20s, early 30s, they didn't waste any time. You know, they really kicked along. And even though blackmail is kind of patchy in terms of how some of the scenes are edited together or what was silent, what's sound, et cetera, as we've been discussing, you know what? It doesn't linger. So things, even if there's a scene that's not working particularly well for whatever reason, and certainly the Alice White character, because of the way those scenes were shot, yeah, it is awkward. It's not dramatically compelling particularly. But you know what? It's not cumbersome because a scene lasts for just a few minutes and then it kicks along to something else. And after all, push come to shove, this is not just a moral drama in terms of the kind of complex moral issues we've been talking about, but it's a chase film. And a chase film has to keep moving. And so I think one of the real virtues of it is, by the time you get to the finale, the home stretch of it, you have that blackmailer very much on the run. And where does he run? Well, he goes to the roof of the British Museum. And it's a very early example in Hitchcock's career of how much Hitchcock loved to use symbolically resonant landmarks.
Yep.
You could show that scene with the blackmailer running across the rooftop. And that, even though there's sound there, that's essentially silent too, because it's a series of pictures. You have a man in silhouette practically, or men in silhouette, running across the roof of one of the most iconic of British buildings, the reading room of the British Library. And of course, dramatically, what will happen when the blackmailer will fall to his death. But in any event, that just visually, it's a knockout sequence. And also the fact that these personal stories, these few characters, if you will, what they're going through, do resonate in ways where you think, well, okay, what does this say about British society as a whole? Well, let's have it be the British, you know, library here, to play it out that way. This is something quite striking in Hitchcock's career, how often you could actually show that scene from Blackmail of him running across the rooftop, and then you might as well just go to North by Northwest and have Cary Grant dangling, you know, with even saying, have them dangling from Mount Rushmore, right? Because, you know, take landmarks, and Hitchcock would do that with the Statue of Liberty, Mount Rushmore, on and on, because, you know, you have what I call the microcosm of a story, these few characters, what they're up against, and then that implicit macrocosm of the larger culture made truly visual, truly evident when some big dramatic scene plays out with the Statue of Liberty or with, you know, Mount Rushmore, any number of other places that Hitchcock loved to put in to the picture there. And you know, he frames them in such a way that at that point it's a kind of symbolic storytelling. And your imagination can extrapolate as much as you want there. But certainly in stories that have any kind of political component, why not have buildings and landmarks and statues and whatever that really do speak to that overall culture, even if the characters themselves never overtly discuss that in dialogue.
Yeah, and even in Vertigo, when she jumps off into the river right next to the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, there so much has been written about Vertigo, but there have been articles and books, indeed, which actually will trace all the actual locations in San Francisco that Hitchcock used, you know, museums and the Golden Gate Bridge and so on, and you know, picture postcard kind of treatment, but how disturbing he could make those picture postcards. You know what I mean? Like, you don't get off easy here. You don't see, that's a pretty picture of the Golden Gate Bridge. Yeah, but look what's happening there, you know?
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing director Alfred Hitchcock and his 1929 film Blackmail. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com in the category Armchair Directors. Tune to Dragon Digital Radio and hear the show a week before it's on Podbean. Rosa Giuliano, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
For the Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, now mind you, a knife is a difficult thing to handle. I mean, any knife. 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 Knife!